Anthony Gormley has created landmark sculptures on a monumental scale in places all around the world. There's his Angel of the North that stands on a hill overlooking the motorways in northern England, and there's his Inside Australia, a work that's made up of 50 black steel figures spread out over a huge salt plain in outback Western Australia. On a much smaller scale and indoors, there's an exhibition of his sculptures on in Melbourne at the moment, although Anthony Gormley himself is in London, and that's where he joins us from. Anthony, can we start by talking about this exhibition? It's called Memes. It's made up of some 33 little human figures that are placed in a large space in a variety of poses, and you've made them from cubes of cast iron. So what is a meme?
Well, meme is something that was coined by Richard Dawkins in his book, The Selfish Gene. And it really means modes of behaviour or figures of thought that are transmitted from human being to human being, culturally. And the idea that forms of body posture that I would equate with states of mind are transmitted in exactly the same way that genes are from body to body, through genetic transmission, through environment, and through, in a way, copied codes of behaviour. And I just like that idea. I like the idea that, you know, a meme could be to the mind-body complex what a gene is, as it were, to the genetic makeup of an individual body. And I wanted people really to, in a sense, be put in the position of looking out over this landscape made of a panoply of different body postures that evoke, I hope, a whole range of both humorous and tragic states of human being.
Well, certainly what they evoke, I think, is a sense of empathy. I mean, all your sculptures do, your figures from the most monumental, like Angel of the North, to smaller figures like these memes that look a bit like, I don't know, a bit like Lego figures or robots in a way. But it seems to me they all do produce an emotional effect when you look at them that is a kind of empathy but not sentimentality. Is it your intention to imbue metal or clay structures with this sort of, to make them empathetic?
Well, the trick for me is, how do you use the most objective, empirical, rational language to evoke the human condition? And the human condition, in many senses since the Enlightenment, has been, I think, figured rationally. And I want to use all of that potential. So I'm really using the language of architecture. You could say the language of the environment that we have built for ourselves to describe what I would like to think of as the inner state of the body. And I like this reference to Lego, because Lego is a system of, you could say, binary symmetries that allow you to build up matrices. And that's what I'm doing. With 27 identical blocks, I have managed to make these 33 very distinct body postures. I say very distinct. There are subtle variations, like the angle of the head, which evoke very, very different kinds of feeling. You know, you only have to move the head 3 millimetres on the size of these figures. They're 38 centimetres high. Move it 3 millimetres forward to change what is an alert, confident thing into a somewhat timid and apprehensive thing. And that, you know, what is sculpture? Sculpture is the attempt to put thought and feeling into inert matter. And that's what I'm doing, but I'm doing it very purposefully, this scale of the model. I was very taken by what Claude Lévi-Strauss said on page 23 of the Vyden and Nicholson edition of The Savage Mind.
I remember it well, page 23.
Well, page 23 is a good page if you are flicking through that excellent. I think it was published in about 1970. I read it when I was 20 in 1970, and it was I've still got my old copy, and that's why I know it quite well. But he talks about, why is it in art that miniaturization is so powerful. And I think it is because in making something small, it comes to us as a totality, as a gestalt, as a complete thing. Now, when we relate to each other, we relate really as a metonymy. In other words, we look at a face, we look at the, in a way, the smile on somebody's lips, the sparkle in their eyes. And we very rarely read the entire body. Well, we do at a distance, and I'm interested in that. You know, if you see your mum approaching you at about, you know, 200 yards away, you can tell whether she's having a good day or whether she's having a shitty day. And I'm interested in the way that actually in our intimate lives, we don't read the totality of the body, but that is what you can do when you make something very small.
And yet so much of what you've done, Anthony, is enormous in size and scale, monumental.
Yeah, but you see, Amanda, the thing is, scale is rather like stone or bronze or plaster. Scale is one of the materials, you could say, or one of the levers that sculpture can use to make you aware. And this is a big, big difference between my work and, say, you know, a little Greek or Roman or a Giovanni Bologna, you know, tiny sculptural group that might be the same size, you know, basically a hand span and a half. I am not interested in representation in the traditional way. I'm interested in, as you say, empathy. But I'm also interested in these objects working on you reflexively so that you become aware of your own body in time and space. And that's exactly how this installation works. The floor on which these works are shown is five steps up from the street level. So the first glance that you have of the exhibition is through a standard door-sized aperture that gives on to this plane where they are more or less at eye level. You then climb up, and in climbing up, you become a giant. You become this huge, godlike bird's eye view that looks down on this field that evokes a multitude of emotional and psychological, I would like to say, states of mind. And the thing that you started with, this notion of empathy, they call upon us to recognize in this model form things that we recognize in our own lives and, in a way, emotional spectrum. And I think you could only do that by playing with scale. So I play with scale. The you know, Angel of the North works exactly the same. You see this tiny thing. Maybe you're coming south. You just cross on the Tyne Bridge. You see in the Lower Teme Valley this tiny thing, tiny, tiny thing on the very kind of edge of the Teme Valley. You then park your car, walk for 300 yards, and you're underneath this enormous thing. Those two experiences are very different, but I want to bring them together. And in getting out of your car and feeling that, you know, prevailing northeasterly wind that chills you to the bone and stand underneath the wings and see them flex, you know, over 3 feet in a good wind, you are aware of your own vulnerability in relation to this 200-ton object that nevertheless shares your basic body topography. And I think that idea of playing with scale, whether it is monumental or whether it is minumental, is very, very important to me as a way of making the art reflexive. In other words, using it as an instrument by which we examine, in an Aristotelian sense, our own life.
I like that you just invented the word monumental too. On ABC Radio National and Artworks, Amanda Smith with you, with the British sculptor Anthony Gormley. Now, Anthony, I was reading on the web the transcript of an interview that you did in 1995 with E.H. Gombrich, Ernst Gombrich, who wrote The Story of Art. And you fessed up to him in this interview that it was The Story of Art, which you read as a school kid, that made you want to be an artist. Can you remember what it was about that book that lit you up?
I think the phrase that occurs in the foreword is, this is not a book about the history of art, but the story of artists. And I think that in that book, he manages to make the story of art an adventure, a human adventure in perception and eye, hand, heart-mind coordination. And it's still a fabulous book. It makes art seem like, you know, the most exciting thing after climbing Mount Everest.
Oh, and the nice thing, too, is that you got to tell him that this book had meant so much to you. And, I mean, he must have been pretty old by the time you were speaking to him in that interview in 1995.
Yeah, well, he was still pretty on top of it. He was very, you know, we were blessed, like the arrival of Freud here. You know, we were blessed by this injection of Central European Jewish intellectuals that came into British life and, yeah, fertilised us. And I bless the dark side of the middle of the 20th century for that fact.
Mm. Now, something else that I was very keen to talk to you about, Anthony, was that you were chosen to do the Wreath Lectures for the BBC this year, the first ever practising artist to be chosen since they started back in 1948. But I understand you're not doing them now, is that right?
No, I'm not doing them. I have profound reservations about, you know, I was educated and I can talk, I can use words, but that's not my primary language. And I wrote two of my lectures, and I realised that in the Wreathian tradition, which is a tradition that puts knowledge transfer very high, yeah, the imperative to make an argument out of your four lectures is pretty implicit. I don't want to make an argument. I would like to open a door for people and allow them to realise that contemporary art is an important part of our human expression, as important as sport or rock music, and that everybody ought to walk through the door into the house of art, as it were, and treat it as their own, as they haven't before. And I realised that I was being pushed into making a platform, an argument for something that I think doesn't need an argument being made for it. And I felt very worried that I was betraying my own calling. I would no doubt be remembered as much for the Wreath Lectures as I would for my own work. And I have told them that I will write the four lectures, which I will.
Well, the BBC's website still has you doing them.
Well, I am dubious about either the correctness or the wisdom of actually delivering them.
Well, can I ask you about something else that didn't happen also, which is the Angel of the North sculpture, your big famous sculpture. There were plans for it to be illuminated green for St Patrick's Day this year, but you said no?
I love St Patrick.
Why did you say no?
I am myself, after being German, Irish.
You have an Irish mother, is that right?
No, I have an Irish father. I have a German mother. But I have insisted that the Angel of the North is never illuminated. I've never wanted it spotlit or floodlit.
Why is that?
Because sculpture is a still thing in a moving world. And, you know, seeing the Angel of the North at night by moonlight or by no light at all, but just against the glow of Gateshead and Newcastle, or in the sunlight, or in rain, or in snow. Seeing it in the different conditions of night, day, and season is absolutely what it does. It is a foil against which the passage of time can, and the changing of the seasons can be registered. Once we turn sculpture into some form of event or performance, it becomes something else. I've done that myself. I'm interested in testing time as I am in testing scale. However, I didn't want this as a precedent. So anyway, they did a test. It got into The Guardian. It was quite a large image on two pages of it green. I was amused, but I didn't feel that them having contacted me, actually it was the Gateshead Evening Post that contacted me and said, what do you think about this? And I said, now that I know about it, I've got to stop it. And I did.
Well, now, a couple of years ago, in 2009, you had the commission for the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square in London. This is the empty plinth that's used there for contemporary art. And for yours, you got members of the public to stand on the plinth. Now, I noticed that for next year, for London's Olympic year, the commission has gone to a pair of artists, Elm Green and Dragset, and they'll be casting a bronze sculpture of a boy on a rocking horse. Can you talk about the fourth plinth as a public place for contemporary art?
Yeah, on one level, this is an indictment about how contemporary art has not been given the opportunity to change public spaces in London. We know the best we can hope for is a bit of cast-off 19th century street furniture that was designed, you know, to carry, as you say, the equestrian statue of William IV, the son of George IV.
That never got made.
That never got made because nobody liked him enough. My reaction to when I was asked very early on in the idea of turning this into a venue for contemporary art was, look, give me the square. You know, I think it's time to move Nelson's Column. It's been there long enough. And who wants all of these valedictory military monuments anyway? And where are the women? And that's never happened. So I was very reluctant. And then I thought, well, look, maybe this isn't a bad opportunity to actually use this rather archaic instrument that talks about, in a sense, the elevated values and moral probity of the statue, the public statue that tells us about great deeds of great men, particularly men. And certainly in Trafalgar Square, it's only men. There are 9 bronze statues of men, most of whom, you know, are, well, responsible for killing lots of other men. I thought, well, let's see whether we can do something really radical with it. And that was why I proposed this project, one and other, which was for the permanent inhabitation of this 14 foot by 5 foot by 24 foot high granite plinth by living people. 24 hours a day, one person for 1 hour, night and day, rain and shine, for the whole of one summer. And we started in July and ended in October. And the idea was really to recognise that in some way we are all heroes now, and we certainly don't need the statue in its original form. Anyway, it was fantastic because 35,000 people applied.
Yes, people were mad keen to do it, weren't they?
Yeah, they really were. And, well, it was a very positive, I think, and wonderful democratisation of the hierarchy of art, certainly public art in its traditional form.
Well, that was in London. If you're in Melbourne, you can see Anthony Gormley's exhibition called Memes. That's at Anna Schwartz Gallery until the 23rd of April. If you're travelling through Western Australia, there's his statues at Lake Ballard, north of Kalgoorlie, the 50 black steel figures that are spread out over the Salt Plain for you to find. And Anthony Gormley, a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Amanda.
You're listening to Artworks with Amanda Smith on ABC Radio National. And I just want to follow up on what Anthony Gormley was saying there about first agreeing to deliver the Wreath Lectures for the BBC this year and then deciding not to. Just when I was getting excited about a visual artist being offered this role as public commentator. So how about we talk a bit more about the place of the artist in the public debate? Terry Smith is the author of What is Contemporary Art? He's also Professor of Contemporary Art at Pittsburgh University, and he's an Australian abroad joining us from Pittsburgh. Terry, Anthony Gormley seems to be assuming that he'd fail if he delivered these lectures. I was assuming he'd succeed, but is he right?
Well, probably, but in a very interesting sense, I think. I think he fears that he'll fail as someone who could perform on the radio as a speaker at the same level that he obviously does and succeeds as an artist, as a visual artist.
It's interesting, though, because we've just heard him speak, and he's very articulate, and he, you know, in his own words, he's articulate, he can talk.
But, Amanda, you're looking at it from the viewpoint of someone who produces radio and who's immersed in it and totally familiar with and very good at it. But giving the Rees lectures is obviously more than that. It's to, as it were, take on the voice of someone who, in a sense, speaks for the nation, for where the country is, or where the nation, or where the society is now, in a particular sense, and is going to go. I mean, it's a major institutional site, if you like, that happens to take the form of a radio. Not even more than a conversation, which is, again, your milieu, but it's more an authoritative statement delivered relatively calmly. But the key thing is that it's an argument that has to be mounted orally and in terms of ideas, and doesn't have the absolutely essential quality of his work, which is that it's a visual statement put before us to apprehend visually.
Yeah. Well, Gormley certainly says that, you know, he thinks it would be betraying his calling as an artist to mount an argument in the form of giving public lectures. But what then is the responsibility of the artist in this day and age to describe, respond to what's happening in the world around them?
Well, in my view, you can't make a rule for everybody, so you can't say the responsibility is. He's talking more about calling. It's different. It's what one as a person or an individual is called to do. It's why you're on the planet. I'm on the planet to offer what I can. And in that sense, I've been called not so much by any great religious authority, but by society as a whole to offer it images of itself, in his case, that are really quite profound and moving, like the Angel of the North image and the fields of those people who look up at us and appeal to us as if they're masses of humanity.
These are the small terracotta figures.
Exactly. And we had the wonderful ones at the Sydney Biennale two or three times back, and they've been in the central desert of Australia, organised by Anthony Bond, and at the Art Gallery in New South Wales, and they've sort of got this magnetic shape that goes through them. And what he's imagining is masses of people, humanity, if you like, before they become individuals in a society. And most of his work is about this very complex thing about being a person, being an individual within societies that tend to measure us all and make us, wish to make us all the same in various ways. So his statements about that on the visual level are really quite profound. I mean, I have differences about certain aspects of them, but they are, you know, they're a kind of argument that's made visually and presented in sequences over time, experienced in space through your eyes, through your body. And this is very different from sitting back and saying, I've got a set of ideas about how English society is now, about how it should go, or about how the world is, and I'm now going to lay that out for you in four or five sequences. It's just a very different, if you like, field of practice. And I think, to put it in a nutshell, he is someone who would wish to do that as well as he does make his own sculptures. And I think he feels that the medium of speaking, so he just couldn't measure up to his own standards. I mean, that's the interpretation I have of what he said.
Well, the controller of BBC Radio 4, where the Rees lectures are broadcast, said when he announced Anthony Gormley as the chosen one for this year, he said, if you go back 150 years, the notion of artists being engaged strongly with the world and having opinions above and beyond their own art form was quite common. And he's suggesting, I guess, that it should be that way now. But I wonder, are the times somehow against that?
Well, in a certain way, because he's probably thinking of Lord Leighton, Millais, you know, yes, very famous people who were amongst the small number of people whose opinions on anything really counted, these aristocrats. That's an utterly different world, and it kind of echoes in the Rees lectures. The Rees lectures really are about, you know, those who rule England letting the rest of us know how to think. One could critically perhaps say that. I like our Boyer lectures better because, you know, we have a much larger range of people, and, you know, we have people such as David Malouf, who is obviously a writer and incredibly articulate and doesn't say, you know, like I've just done four times. and it's very poetic and very beautiful in the way in which he can evoke a sense of what it is to be Australian now. So maybe it's something to do with the format, you know, the authoritative voice has to speak on these matters. Certainly your question goes to the issue that nowadays we don't have, thank God, we don't have small sets of people running our society in the same kind of manner. We have small sets of people who wish to do so, but they're not succeeding in doing so.
Well, what about can entering into the public debate, not directly through the art you make, but by speaking publicly in some way, as in through these lectures, can it make a contribution, though, that your art in and of itself can't make? For example, I'm thinking of the playwright Harold Pinter, you know, when he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2005. In his acceptance speech, he used the opportunity to talk about art and truth and politics and truth, and he was deeply, deeply critical of the invasion of Iraq and, in fact, US foreign policy since the end of World War II, really. Was that well done or ill-judged, do you reckon?
I thought it was brilliant, and I actually quoted in my book, towards the last chapter, I speak about the issue of speaking truth to power, how difficult it is to speak truth to power, which is a great statement by Edward Said about the responsibility of all intellectuals to speak truth to power. And he did so, I thought, in the most brilliant manner. He spoke about how difficult it was to write plays about lies, deception and self-deception and the sort of bad language that we are most of us immersed in most of the time. And to do so at the time he did, when the United States was still led by the Bush administration, which had developed the idea of lying to its people in the most highly sophisticated but at the same time crude form, it was a very important lecture that he gave.
And yet Pinter was criticised for making political judgments when he was an artist, a dramatist, not a political expert.
That's a standard reaction by conservatives who make political statements all the time about anything, including about the matter that we're talking. It's a political thing to say that only political people can make statements about the world and artists shouldn't do so. Conservatives regularly, particularly in this country, attack everyone under the sun except themselves and constantly make political statements of that ridiculous kind. The work of many, many artists engages with matters of the world, how the world is and how it was, how it should be. One of the great functions of art is to add subtlety and complexity and a useful ambiguity, a sort of poetic ambiguity, to how the world appears. So people who insist that you only speak within the expert range that you happen to be, you know, committed to, people who have that view are really trying to close down public speech, and they're trying to close down the openness to complexity that we need to survive in the contemporary world.
Well, Anthony Gormley also said that he didn't want to be remembered more for giving the Rees lectures than for his actual art. And I'm just thinking about that in relation to the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei, who's again in the headlines at the moment. Chinese authorities are constantly getting at him, you know, controlling his movements, as much, if not more, I'd suggest, because of what he says about the exercise of power in China than for how he might allude to that in his art. I wonder if there's a danger that he'll be remembered more for being a dissident artist than for the art itself.
Well, maybe his art is precisely to create these provocations and always be on the border of being arrested, in a sense. If you look closely at nearly all of his work, it's based on, in art terms, we immediately recognise the strategies of Marcel Duchamp that go right back to the early 20th century, where you propose something, anything, let's say a toilet bowl, as a sculpture, and then see what happens, which is what Duchamp did, one of the things that he did. But what Duchamp regularly did was take the ordinary practices and procedures and behaviours of everyday life and alter them just a little tiny bit, put them out in public, and realise that that could create absolute chaos and disturbance. So what Ai Weiwei does, in fact, is spend most of his time filing complaints or gathering information in vast amounts of detail about various things that the government doesn't want him to gather information about. What he nearly always does is follow the exact procedures of the people who are following him. So when the police are constantly filming his house, he has people filming the police. When he wanders around and they film him or track him, he has friends going around tracking the police. So he's driving them absolutely crazy. This is something that doesn't necessarily get reported, but what he's doing is exposing, as he says, the way in which China's becoming a police state by actually holding up a mirror to what's in fact going on. Now, his art that's shown in galleries and museums is very much of that kind, and it's mostly about that kind of thing. So you can't separate the two. That's what the conservative people were doing before, to separate the two. You can't separate the two.
Yeah. Well, and in his case, certainly you can't. No, but in the case of those who do, you know, if as an artist you leave it entirely for your work to speak for you, are you in some ways marginalising yourself from being, you know, a player in the world, from making a contribution to public discourse and therefore elevating the status of the artist and art?
Well, it depends what kind of artist you are and what tradition you're working within, obviously. There's a value in doing work that we call, if you like, it's parallel to working in a laboratory. I mean, certain artists are really good and very helpful to everybody else, every other artist, because they do work that is really about art practices or art procedures. It's like doing pure science. And again, as I said before, there are no rules for all artists, as for any group of people or class or category of people, that have to mean that everyone behaves the same way if they're in X, Y, and Z category. That's just the wrong way of thinking about the world. So, you know, I admire highly formal artists. I admire people like Richard Serra, who, you know, if you wanted to read them politically, you'd have to say were profoundly conservative, but they themselves wouldn't see themselves like that and don't behave like that politically. But they divide their life up. What they do, however, is they keep on innovating within an artistic tradition that is now a couple of centuries old, and that to me is a really admirable thing to do if you do it extremely well. Other artists are directly politically engaged, and you could barely see the art of their work, except it's very artful in its political engagement, and Ai Weiwei is one of those people. We have many more such people around the world who are working on questions of, you know, governmental surveillance, or they're working on climate change ideas and issues and doing them in a variety of fashions, including some of our own artists like Patricia Piccinini and Emily Floyd, many artists, all of many kinds. So the answer has to vary depending on the kind of art that we're looking at.
And Terry Smith is the author of the book What is Contemporary Art? He's Professor of Contemporary Art at the University of Pittsburgh, and it's from Pittsburgh that he joins us. Now, Terry, I think you're coming back to Australia next month, aren't you, to get some sort of prize?
Some kind of award. The award is the Australia Council Visual Arts Award, which I'm totally delighted by. It's the first time that it's actually been given to an art writer. And to also give it to someone who spends half their time overseas, and I do spend the other half of my time in Australia, where, by the way, I've just agreed to take up a distinguished visiting chair at the new National Institute for Experimental Arts that the College of Fine Arts at New South Wales University is establishing. So that's what I'll be doing when I come back.
Well, congrats on both counts, and thank you for joining us here in Artworks, Terry.
Okay. Thanks, Amanda. Thank you.
Music today provided by Spoonbill. This is ABC Radio National, on air and online, and artworks.